truck struck the two girls before colliding with a large wooden business sign.
A drunk driver kills two teenage girls in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Begich visits Galena to see the damage firsthand.
If this was farm country, we'd have millions in immediate disaster relief.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska,
and by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Anchorage police have charged 31-year-old Stacy Allen Graham after he crashed, killing two teenage girls Friday evening. APD spokeswoman Danny Myron says it happened around 6:45 near Abbott Road and 88th Street.
The pickup truck was coming from Diamond Boulevard and approaching the Abbott curve when it apparently lost control and swerved onto the bike path located to the west side of Abbott Road, just north of 88th Street, where the two girls were walking. The truck struck the two girls before colliding with a large wooden business sign. The truck ended up on its side.
15-year-old Brooke McFeeder and 15-year-old Jordan Deere were pronounced dead at the scene. The roof of Graham's vehicle was removed in order to extract him from the vehicle. He was transported to a hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. Preliminary alcohol tests indicate Graham had about three times the legal limit of alcohol in his system at the time of the crash. He has been charged with operating under the influence and two counts of murder, too. The girls were reportedly walking home from Diamond Center after shopping for back-to-school items. Alaska Senator Mark Begich and Washington Senator Maria Cantwell got a firsthand view of Galena's flood damage. The U.S. senators toured the town on Friday as they continue to push for a federal appropriation for disaster areas that rely heavily on seafood for economy and sustenance. KIYU's Jeremy Scott was there.
Begich and Cantwell originally tried in late 2012 to tack the Commerce and Justice Appropriations Bill, as they're calling it, onto the Hurricane Sandy bill, but Cantwell says the legislation hit a brick wall with some colleagues who, at the time, still didn't see seafood as a vital industry.
There's some people who didn't even want to move forward on Sandy.
Right.
I mean, I give Mark a lot of credit because he really described the situation of disaster relief as it related to the Galena community in a way that really, you know, just made the light bulb go off in a lot of people's head.
Fast forwarding to today, the bill recently passed through the Senate Appropriations Committee and is now waiting to be heard on the Senate floor.
It's about $150 million appropriation. We've been able to get it in the appropriations bill, which was great. That means $150 million for three areas: Alaska, the YK area, as well as the Gulf of Mexico. There's a certain species down there that has run into a problem, as well as in New England states.
Additionally, the pending bill says the FDA must label genetically modified fish. Begich says between that mandate and the money the bill would garner for flood-ravaged areas that rely on seafood, the bill's passage would set a long-term precedent for future seafood legislation.
If this was farm country, we'd have millions in immediate disaster relief. But it's almost like the fishing communities, if you live on the ocean or on the river, because we harvest from the water, we're not in the same category as if you harvest on land. Now, we know that's not correct, but that's how the policies have been developed over the years. We should be equal treatment.
While the bill pens a full Senate hearing, Begich says its passage will depend on how far his colleagues have come since Sandy and their belief in seafood as a viable industry. He hopes his and Cantwell's pictures and stories from their trip to Galena will help their cause.
Senator Cantwell and I went out to a fish camp, and we were talking to the families that are out there, and that their quantity of salmon is going to be much lower this year for a couple reasons. The river's running with less, but also they spend a lot of time taking care of their flood-damaged property, so they weren't out laying nets. And so it's another, you know, personal real-life example that we can put on the table.
Reporting from Galena, I'm Jeremy Scott.
A new audit by the U.S. Department of Transportation's Inspector General finds the Port of Anchorage expansion project had botched oversight and bad cost estimates. Lisa Diemer is a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. She has reported extensively on the port expansion and the troubles surrounding cost and design.
And this explains some of that on how the project got to be so inflated in cost, or the cost estimates went up so much, in that the federal agency, which was assigned to oversee the finances, the U.S. Maritime Administration, did not do its own cost estimates and instead relied on the contractor to come up with figures. And so that's one key finding from this one that really does explain a lot.
It seems from their name, the U.S. Maritime Administration, that they would be the folks that you would think you'd turn to oversee such projects. But it doesn't appear to be that way from the tone of the report. What is their usual function, and how did this get so off track?
They had not managed a port project before. This was the first big port expansion they had been tasked with. And they were contracted, that the city in 2003 signed an agreement with them to run this project. And some of the logic behind that was, well, they were expecting it to be largely federally funded, better for a federal agency to handle those federal, at that point, earmarks. Now, this study says that this agency, which goes by MARAD, but the Maritime Administration, did say that it allowed the local officials to handle the technical and programmatic aspects of the project. Now, the city has said it put MARAD in charge. So that's one of the things. There still seems to be some finger pointing.
There does seem to be a lot of finger pointing going back and forth between local and federal officials. With that in mind, will this report resolve anything and help kind of get things on track as far as this port expansion? Or what do you see at the end of this as to whether or not it's helpful?
I think it lays things out and explains some of the key decisions. It was really a look at the federal agency to see, should it be doing these kinds of projects? How can it do them better? You know, kind of your classic audit of a government agency. With a lot of recommendations for better controls and, tighter practices. And so that was the focus of it. For the Anchorage project, this agency's role, it's really too late. There's no more federal money left for the project. They've spent more than $300 million. The audit, for the purposes of the Anchorage port project, probably doesn't make that much difference.
So the federal money has ran out, but there's still work that needs to be done. Is it known how things are going to progress into the future now, or is the port project sort of in a holding pattern?
Mayor Dan Sullivan has said that the city expects to pick a new design soon. They're looking for they're working with other engineers now and looking at the best way to finish this project, or at least build something that'll be usable and last into the future. So the city's working on a new plan. They want to hire within the next couple of months, a new contract manager to oversee what is a pretty complex project. I mean, they're having to do this work in the inlet, dealing with tides, beluga whales, lots of complications for construction.
Lisa Diemer is a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, helping new teachers adjust to life in rural Alaska.
There's so many people that come in and I think they expect it to be different, to be a lot like the lower 48, and it's not.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com.
This week, Alaska lawmakers and government officials are meeting in Anchorage to discuss what they see as federal overreach. The two-day summit is being put on by the Department of Natural Resources Advisory Commission, and organizers say the goal is to examine points of conflict with the federal government over land management, resource development, access issues, and fish and wildlife policy. Governor Sean Parnell opened the summit at the Dena'ina Center this morning, describing federal overreach as a disease that afflicts our nation.
Now in Alaska, federal overreach looks like, one, harassment of Alaska natives harvesting sea otter, blocking King Cove residents from access to health and safety personnel, failure to hold timely lease sales and delayed permitting decisions, attempting to add new and more onerous designations on land our citizens that we're already blocked from accessing and utilizing for our benefit.
The federal government is the largest landowner in the state, controlling about two-thirds of its acreage. But it puts a lot of money into the state, too, nearly $10 billion. Parnell acknowledged that this tension makes the issue of federal overreach controversial. Despite many strong words for the federal government, Parnell noted that the state and federal government are not always in opposition. He said there are some lawsuits where the state has sided with the federal government. The summit wraps up tomorrow with a roundtable and an address by Alaska's congressional delegation and a former assistant secretary of the Department of Interior. No officials currently with federal agencies were invited to participate. A new wildfire near Fairbanks is adding to a complex late wildfire season in the interior. The Caribou Creek Fire is burning about 36 miles northeast of Harding Lake, about 20 miles east of the 85,000-acre Stewart Creek Fire. Fire Information Officer Jim Schwarber says the new fire has consumed about 1,400 acres after being discovered by a pilot yesterday afternoon.
We had a report just before 3 p.m. Of a small half-acre fire in the upper Salcha River. By the time our aircraft arrived overseas, it was already up to 100 acres burning aggressively in black spruce on a hillside up above the Salcha River.
Schwarber says about 50 firefighters, as well as air tankers and water scooping planes, were deployed on the blaze in an effort to protect mining claims and historic dredge and recreational cabins in the area.
We were able to check the progress of the fire on the south perimeter with retardant, so the fire burned primarily towards the north, away from the river, and again, we tried to slow it down when it reached the ridge top there, about 3-4 miles from the river there. So we have it boxed in, but it's not contained at this point.
Schwarber says the fire slowed overnight and additional crews are being brought in. He says its cause is not certain, but there was no lightning in the area. North of Fairbanks, the Birch Creek Fire has also been growing about 3 miles east of Circle Hot Springs. Schwarber says air and ground resources are being used to try to keep the more than 24,000-acre fire from spreading west toward populated areas. Meanwhile, the Mississippi Fire near Delta Junction is getting a lot of attention. The fire sprang to life last week, ballooning to 41,000 acres by late Friday. Information Officer Pete Buse says strong south winds fanned the flames north onto state lands.
The wind had been out of the south. That's what drove it to the north and sent a lot of smoke even into Fairbanks. But yesterday afternoon, the wind changed to a westerly wind. And, of course, that smoked in Delta and the Alaska Highway and the Richardson Highway.
Buse says the primary focus of fire crews is protection of the Whitestone Farm community west of Delta and the South Bank development on the Tanana River. He says structures north of the river are also under watch in case winds shift to out of the south again. For the past 9 years, Alaska Airlines and Peninsula Airways have partnered to provide regular passenger service to Unalaska. That service has been plagued by delays and has also suffered from the airline's failure to communicate with passengers and even internally with each other. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal sat down with representatives from both Alaska Airlines and Peninsula Airways to find out why it's so hard to fly to Unalaska.
The service isn't supposed to be any different from what Alaska Airlines offers itself.
Think of Unalaska as actually flying on Alaska Airlines. When you're getting on a Pan Air flight, that's really an Alaska Airlines flight.
That's Alaska Airlines sales director Scott Haberstadt. He says Alaska Airlines charters the flights from Pan Air and operates them under their own safety standards. So passengers get perks like frequent flyer miles and free checked bags if they're Alaskan. But when something goes wrong, it becomes apparent that a charter flight is not an Alaska Airlines flight. The rules for rebooking passengers are different because two airlines have to coordinate. Penn Air CEO Danny Siebert explains.
So our Alaska Airlines calls, there's been a weather delay in Dutch. What can you do tomorrow? And then here we will juggle the airplanes.
On another route, Alaska Airlines might automatically rebook customers. But Penn Air only has 10 aircraft in the state of Alaska. Finding an empty seat or an empty plane isn't easy. So every canceled passenger goes on a standby list. But the standby list isn't usually shared with passengers. It's kept private between the airlines, so most passengers don't know when they're supposed to be leaving. And that creates a slew of other problems.
What happens a lot of the time is people get impatient. Seafood companies get impatient, and they hop another airline.
Meaning they charter a plane at great expense. If enough people leave on their own, other standby passengers may suddenly move to the top of the list. If they aren't in the terminal ready to board, they miss their new flight. This system, the standby list, is supposed to give the airlines time to coordinate without dragging passengers into it. But not sharing information with the passengers creates other problems. Siebert is the president of Penn Air, and Haberstad markets this route for Alaska Airlines, and they know that this system doesn't always work.
We both personally have worked many, many standby lists, and it's not something you see at a company that you have people at our level of management that go to the counter and get involved with the standby list. You have people constantly yelling at you, asking you to be bumped up on the list, or where am I on the list?
If I had a silver bullet and it had one shot, that's what I would shoot to fix.
Fixing the standby list would clear up confusion among passengers, but it wouldn't fix the underlying issue, why people get stranded in the first place. There are a few reasons for that, but Siebert says Penn Air is to blame for a major one.
The airplane wasn't designed to do what we're using it for today, and I think that's the biggest challenge.
Penn Air only owns Saab 340 planes. They're good for commuter flights, Siebert says, not 800-mile hauls across the Bering Sea.
So here we are on a perfect day. We're taking a 34-passenger airplane knowing that because of the stage length and the field requirements and to maintain the safety parameters, we can only take 23.
The solution to that would be larger planes, but that's expensive for Penn Air, and it might exacerbate another issue.
Unalaska has polarized demand. Everybody wants to go to Unalaska at one time or from Unalaska at one time. And so you'll look during the A season, we're full one way and completely empty the other.
That's just the nature of the fishing business. If Penn Air switched to bigger planes, there would just be more empty seats to fill, and neither airline wants to take on that financial burden. Lopsided demand, bad weather, upstart charter services, stealing passengers, those issues aren't going away. And on top of them, there's going to be more demand.
The reality is, we didn't expect Shell last year. I mean, Shell hit us hard.
Last year's drilling season is nothing compared to what might be ahead. The Alaska Department of Transportation is already projecting 40,000 passengers will fly out of the Unalaska airport by 2020, compared to 28,000 that went through 5 years ago. Add in oil company personnel, and it could be a lot more than that. Haberstad says the load would be welcome.
And it's good for the community, because it's more business that's coming in, it's more opportunity that's coming in, the community continues to grow and strengthen.
But for a community that's off the road system, growth is tied to reliable transportation. That means more capacity, but it also means on-time service and better communication between the airlines and their passengers. Those aren't easy fixes, but with increasing traffic on the route, the airlines, and on Alaska, can't afford to wait. I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The village of Kivalina in northern Alaska has finally begun to fill its water storage tanks again after spending last winter with dwindling reserves. Crews at the water plant began pumping water round the clock on Friday. The Inupiat Eskimo community of 400 fell into its water crisis after the local water supply pipeline was damaged by late summer storms last year before its water tanks could be filled. Kivalina is located 83 miles north of the Arctic Circle. The large all-tide dock in Dillingham has been partially reopened after being closed last Thursday because of damage. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
The all-tide dock in Dillingham is one of the major points of entry for goods and equipment into the Bristol Bay region. Damage to the dock was discovered last week, resulting in the dock being closed. Dillingham City Manager Rose Louetta confirms that a portion of the dock was reopened on Sunday.
250 feet of the south end of the dock is now open. We've blocked off about 80 feet of where the piling had separated off. We've excavated the pressure from the piling and now looking for a company to come in to do the repair.
The exact cause of the damage to the all-tide dock is still unknown, and the exact cost to repair the damage is also unknown. Louetta confirms that the open section of the dock is still too small to accommodate some of the larger barges that use the dock.
It's not enough to accommodate the 400-foot barges. Northland is bringing over a smaller barge, about 250 feet. They're unloading the larger barge in Naknek now onto a smaller barge and will be lightering the things over here.
Louetta says it's possible the materials needed to fix the all-tide dock can be obtained locally, and she says the repair effort that will be undertaken over the next couple of weeks should be a permanent fix. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Teachers headed to the Northwest Arctic Borough School District spent some time learning Inupiaq language, crafts, and culture at a traditional fish camp this summer in preparation for their new jobs. The camp is one of two in the state that's aimed at improving cultural understanding among incoming teachers and to help with teacher retention. And it seems to be working. As part of our ongoing series on defining what culture means in Alaska, KSKA's Daisha Eaton visited the camp near Kayana and has this story.
Most of the new teachers have never gutted a fish, gone tundra trekking, or used a honey bucket. Sitting on the corner of his tent platform, wearing his new rubber boots, Kevin Foster says he wasn't expecting the region where he'll soon be teaching to be so soggy or remote.
When I came out here, I kind of thought that it would be like cabins, and I kind of thought that it would be like paved, like walkways, and it was just, no, this is a whole new terrain.
The camp sits along the sloping bank of the Kobuk River, about 8 miles up from Kayana. There's no electricity or running water, and the only form of communication and sometimes entertainment is a VHF radio in the cookhouse.
Can't wait for dinner.
There's also a fish drying rack and a half dozen wooden platforms topped with tents. It's about 30 miles north of the Arctic Circle and thousands of miles from the cities and suburbs of the lower 48, where most of the dozen or so early career teachers studied. Foster grew up in a mostly black neighborhood on the south side of Chicago and went to college in Iowa. Local kids taught him some Inupiaq.
Akla. Akla. Akla.
Like akla bear.
Akla bear.
An ugly bear?
Akla bear.
The 24-year-old will soon teach preschool in the tiny village of Shungnak. Alaska has long counted on a steady stream of eager graduates to fill the state's most remote teaching positions. But the teacher turnover rate in some villages is as high as 30% to 50%. The Alaska Humanities Forum, along with tribal groups and school districts, is trying to improve that rate through the 10-day cultural immersion program. Elizabeth Yandel is another incoming teacher from Seattle.
You know, they tell you before you come here that the mosquitoes are awful and that they're worse than you imagine. And I was imagining pretty bad, but the reality is still shocking.
Yandel will teach middle school and high school language arts in the hub community of Kotzebue. She sits around a table sewing with kids and elders.
Right now, the ladies are making atikloks. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. The kids keep correcting me.
And this is the back.
Yandel says meeting local residents made her feel more prepared for her new job.
I'm so grateful for this experience, just to help me become comfortable with Alaska and to really realize that this was the right decision for me and that this really is the place for me to be right now.
Victoria Morris helps coordinate daily activities at the camp and leads the hands-on portion of the college course teachers are enrolled in. As part of the course, she teaches them the values of local residents.
Our traditions, our values, our subsistence lifestyle. I'm also introducing them to what life is like living in the village in a rural, isolated area. Exposing them to the costs of living up here.
The program doesn't sugarcoat the challenges of living in the bush. Teachers go grocery shopping to get familiar with high prices and visit with state troopers to learn about law enforcement issues such as alcoholism and sexual assault. But they're also introduced to the positives, like the opportunity to build a strong sense of community and to learn to live off of the land. Nina Kempel is the CEO of the Alaska Humanities Forum, which funds the program. She's spending a few days at the camp with the new teachers. The overarching goal of the program, she says, is to improve education in rural districts.
The rationale behind this program is that if we can keep teachers in the schools longer, especially new teachers new to Alaska in schools longer, teaching for 3 to 4 years, we actually increase student achievement through that.
Kempel says they're already seeing results. Tracy Bell was in the first group of teachers who went through the training last summer. She came back. The course helped her make the transition from living in Lansing, Michigan, she says, to life in the village of Selawik. She says it gave her an idea of what to expect.
Just to be open-minded to the culture. I mean, there's so many people that come in and I think they expect it to be different, to be a lot like the lower 48, and it's not, but just to be open to all the changes and flexible and just to realize that, you know, we're outsiders coming in.
That's something the camp seemed to drive home for Foster as well. He says he believes what he learned through the program will help him relate to his students.
And this is what they do for their summer. You know, they go fishing and they get fish and they save it up for the year. Like, just talking about this experience, like, what'd you do over the summer? Like, oh, we went fishing at fish camp. Oh, yeah, I did that too.
That's just the kind of thing that organizers of the program are hoping for. The Humanities Forum says around 90% of the teachers who participated in the program last year returned to teach in rural Alaska a second year. Organizers hope the program may become a model for districts across the state.
I'm sharpening the odor.
In Kiana, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Our series on culture in Alaska is funded by the Alaska Humanities Forum. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Jeremy Scott in Galena, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.